Lost and Sound is sponsored by Audio Technica. And right now I'm wearing a pair of their ATH M50 headphones. I love them. They fit great and snug. They're for the studio or out and about, like where I am, on a street in Berlin. Audio Technica are a global but family-run company that make headphones, turntables, cartridges, microphones, studio quality, yet affordable products. Because they believe that high-quality audio should be accessible to all. So, wherever you are in the world, head on over to AudioTechnica.com to check out all of their range of stuff. And welcome to episode 128 of Lost and Sound. I'm Paul Hampford, I'm your host. I'm an author, a broadcaster and a lecturer. And Lost and Sound is the weekly podcast where I chat with an artist who works outside the box. From global icons to trailblazing outsiders and emerging innovators, we talk music, creativity, and perhaps that most daunting part of being an artist, the praxis of life. Previous guests have included Peaches, Suzanne Ciani, Jim O'Rourke, Chili Gonzalez, Cozy Fanny Tutti, Jean-Michel Jarre, Mickey Blanco, and Thurston Moore. And today on the show, my guest isn't known for making music, but rather writing about it. And when it comes to writing about electronic music, he's one of the best. Author, reporter, and global raver, Matthew Collin. Meanwhile, my book, Coming to Berlin, is still available in all good bookshops or via the publisher's website, Velocity Press. And when I was writing the book, there were just a handful of music writers who really had an influence on me. Simon Reynolds, David Toop, the usual suspects, and particularly high on this list, Matthew Collin. Matthew Collin is a veteran reporter and editor who, over a career spanning over 30 years, has worked as a foreign correspondent for the BBC and Al Jazeera, and he's been an editor at a Big Issue and ID magazine. And not only that, written two of the most seminal books about electronic music you can possibly find, Altered State and Rave On, both of which examine the culture of raving. And now he's written a third electronic music book that I think without a doubt will also become seminal. It's called Dream Machines, and this is what we speak mostly about in what you're about to hear. It's subtitled Electronic Music in Britain, from Doctor Who to Acid House. And it focuses on a period of musical development in Britain that began after the Second World War and ends just on the cusp of the rave explosion in the late 80s. I haven't finished reading it yet. I've been delving in, picking chapters at random. There are chapters on everything from bleep techno to dub reggae, from Delia Derbyshire to industrial. And I'm treating it like going into a record shop and picking out something different to listen to, or in this case, read, every time I open it. Collin's writing crackles with this energy of the music that he's exploring and the cultural context behind it. I found it really fascinating getting this viewpoint, rather than differently from a music maker, but a serious writer who has not only investigated so deep and thoroughly the world of the music that he loves and he's exploring, but he actually lives it too as a raver. So what you're about to hear is me talking with Matthew Collin. We had this chat last week, actually. So towards the end of April 2024, this is me talking with Matthew Collin for Lost and Sound podcast. So the new book, Dream Machines, is subtitled Electronic Music in Britain from Doctor Who to Acid House. What made you want to write about this?
Well, I think what I wanted to do was write a kind of tribute, maybe even a love letter even, to these kind of formative decades of electronic music in Britain, because they seem to me to be so full of optimism and energy, and the this kind of thrill of exploring what at that time really were these kind of uncharted sonic worlds. So the book kind of goes from the early experimental avant-garde pioneers just after the Second World War to the kind of peaks of like synth pop and then acid house in the 80s, taking in psychedelia, space rock, dub, electro, industrial music, hip hop, even high energy along the way. So it's quite a journey. And what I wanted to do was show how electronic music in the UK has been this kind of culture of idealists and progressives, like dreaming of brighter futures and expressing their visions through technology. And I mean, while the book tells the stories of these pioneers of electronic music in Britain, it also looks at how the music was shaped by the social and cultural environments of the time, and all the kind of subcultures, the scenes and the communities that kind of collectively nurtured innovations in music. And I mean, obviously no account of electronic music in the UK or anywhere else is ever going to be kind of definitive or comprehensive, but what I wanted was for this one to be at least a bit more inclusive.
And in what way do you feel that the book makes more of an inclusive portrayal of all of these different interweaving, sometimes totally not connected, other times sort of like very randomly connected or socially connected players and elements over this timeline?
I think I took a very like liberal definition of what is electronic music. So it includes the early music concrete that was made on tape recorders, but it also includes things like hip hop, which some people might not consider electronic music, and then things like high energy, which have generally been left out of histories of electronic music, at least to some extent, and kind of got lost in history in a way. Also, what I wanted to do was somehow try and capture that feeling of beautiful strangeness that for me is really at the heart of the best electronic music. I start with this anecdote from an interview I did with Mad Professor, the dub reggae producer, and he was talking about how when he was growing up, he thought that the sounds coming out of the radio, the voices coming out of the radio, was some kind of magic. So he took the radio apart to find out where they're coming from. And once he dismantled this radio, he still couldn't find this magic. So he started building his own electronic equipment and then making his own music. And that was all to locate the source of the magic he was looking for. And to me, that was kind of what electronic music is all about, this kind of constant attempt to create something that's wonderful and magical and tries to take us out of this world and into the uncharted realms of the imagination, as it were.
Yeah, and I definitely get that from reading it. One of the things that I really love about the book is some of your descriptions for the sounds of the music as well. I think in terms of like being a journalist and a writer, I always remember there was this kind of like cliche about like in the 90s, like shoegaze being described as always like, like crescending cathedrals of sound. And, that kind of language became very cliched, but you managed to find really interesting ways of describing the music. Was that quite important to you to sort of make the book feel very tactile to read? And because it does to me.
I think, what you always want is for your writing about music to make people want to go off and listen to the music and to explore it. And then you could never describe music exactly, but you can give an impression that potentially inspires people to go and investigate further. And I think that's ideally what you'd like to achieve with writing about music.
Yeah, definitely. And the other thing that I feel like I really pick up on it as well, that kind of echoes through into your earlier books, like you've written some of the most seminal books about electronic music culture, like Altered State and Rave On. is that you always take a kind of very cultural perspective, and you talked a little bit about that earlier on. What do you feel that we can gain as readers and as music fans to understand more about the cultural context that music is created in?
And obviously, no music and no art, no culture is created in a vacuum, is it? Isn't it? It's always shaped by its environment. It's always affected by what's happening in society, whether it's reflecting that or reacting against it. So I don't think that there's such a thing as music that's outside its time at all. And so throughout the book, starts off, as I said, just after the Second World War, and Second World War had this enormous impact on the development of electronic music in Britain, but for a few reasons. I mean, firstly, you had all these people who went off to fight. They were in the forces, and they picked up new skills like electronic engineering, radar, things like that. And then they came back with these skills and applied it to music music making. It also, the Second World War, made this new electronic equipment available. The armed forces sold off surplus stock, and you started getting all these shops selling oscillators and other pieces of electronic equipment in places like London. And it's, as one of the early pioneers, Tristan Carey, he said that if you knew what you were doing with these electronic things, you can make them do something different from what they were initially intended to do. So this, again, this points to another theme that runs throughout the book, that is technology intended for other functions being repurposed for creative objectives. And that's certainly a recurring theme throughout the history of electronic music in Britain.
Yeah, and I picked up on that a lot. I was just, so I'm sort of diving into different chapters at different times. And so I was reading the chapter about dub reggae, and that's definitely an aspect where equipment was really, really, really pushed to the limits. Can you think of any other examples as well where you see that equipment being kind of completely reappropriated or pushed to its limits in ways that, you know, weren't really set out for them to be made like that?
I think the first and one of the most important examples of that was the tape recorder. Now, tape recorders, only these reel-to-reel tape recorders, only became commercially available after the Second World War into the 1950s. The tape recorder changed the way people thought about sound because it turned sound into, I think it was Brian Eno described it as turning sound into something that was malleable, that was cuttable, reversible, something that could be reordered and manipulated, and it could be run backwards, it could be sped up, slowed down. You could cut the tape up and change the order. Essentially, that meant that sound was no longer linear. It could be shifted around. So that had an enormous impact, and that really offered access to these new sonic worlds. And it also made the means of kind of avant-garde music production accessible to the wider public. Once tape recorders came down in price in the 1950s, you started to get this subculture of amateur tape recorder enthusiasts emerging. And this was all around Britain. People building their own home studios. I mean, in a sense, they were the kind of the predecessors of the bedroom techno producers in the 80s and 90s. So for around a decade from, you know, about the late 1950s, you had this amateur tape recording scene, and which had the specialist clubs and societies all around the country, and enthusiasts who were setting up studios in their garden sheds or their living rooms. They would kind of come together at these societies and play each other their latest experience. I mean, they weren't all music. Some of them were kind of speech and drama and stuff like that. But you did get people experimenting with making avant-garde sounds. And this is really, really interesting how this kind of do-it-yourself ethos. This is, again, this is another theme that runs through the book, this kind of a very British kind of make do and mend, assembling stuff in your garage or your garden shed, creating these contraptions and then trying to make sounds using whatever you can get your hands on, really.
It's very Wallace and Gromit, isn't it?
Well, it's as I say, people using whatever equipment they can get to make the sounds that are in their minds. It goes back to the start of the story in the post-World War II period, from when people were buying these old ex-military oscillators and other kind of cast-off technology from these army surplus stores. And it goes right through to the acid house era when amateur producers DJs were using cheap samplers and kind of cracked software, secondhand Roland 808s, 303s, and to make music at home. One of the guys from Orbital, one of the Orbital Hartnell brothers, told me this great story about when they made Chime, which was their kind of rave classic, their first massive track. When they made it at their parents' home back in the late 80s, he said that the biggest expense was the money they had to spend on a high quality cassette to actually master the track, and that cost them £3.50, and they were worried that might be too expensive at the time.
I mean, I love that, and I love this whole idea that you know, as you mentioned, that a lot of the early experiments were very avant-garde, but previously the idea of musicianship and avant-garde kind of connected people to this idea of a very Western tradition of like being educated, being affluent enough to be educated, having a certain kind of, you know, background to be able to read music and have access to music. And electronic music and like the tape recorder kind of really changed this as well. And that kind of feeds in a lot to your ideas about like perhaps about inclusivity. Do you see that has changed at all? You know, now that the electronic dance music industry is such a sort of, is a billion, you know, I think it's valued at like 11 million or some a year now. Sorry, 11 billion a year now. Do you see that's kind of under threat at all? Now there is such big investment and people aren't so sort of, you know, DIY about stuff.
I think you can still make a track for virtually nothing in your bedroom. I think what has changed is that there is just so much more music than there ever has been, and at the same time you've got virtually the entire history of recorded sound is now click away from you, when previously a lot of this stuff was really rather obscure. So the landscape is completely different. But I think there is still an outlet for non-musicians to make music, and that's something that certainly started in the kind of early era of electronic music concrete. In the early 60s, there wasn't even such a thing as a synthesizer player, and no one knew what a synthesizer was. You only started getting people defining themselves as synthesizer players in the 1970s. So I think the landscape has massively changed and will continue to change with the use of generative AI to create music. We have no idea what impact that's going to have at this point. It's certainly going to make much, much more music. And so to navigate your way as a creative artist in that environment is probably much harder than it was in the 1960s and 70s, when there wasn't that much that had gone before. And it was much, much easier to be weird in a way.
yeah, definitely. And another thing you mentioned as a recurring theme seems to me about like how imitation kind of can create innovation. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, I think there's always this impression that people have that musical innovation is created by these geniuses and pioneers who are unique figures within culture. But oftentimes it's not really like that at all. You know, innovations are the product of all sorts of different people doing all sorts of different things around the same time that then coalesce into an innovation.
Why did you decide to finish at 1989 as well?
I think the late 1980s was a really kind of fast-moving period in British pop culture and electronic music, when you had the introduction of cheaper samplers and sequencing computers, which, you know, completely democratized electronic music making. And all this set the scene for the 1990s, when you had an explosion of musical forms. And certainly within dance music culture, you know, you had jungle, drum and bass, trance, trip hop, UK garage, and so on. And as I say at the end of the book, it was a time when it seemed like anything could be possible, and it all kind of exploded like in a creative inferno. And what I wanted to do was end at a point where the culture is just on the verge of this enormous explosion, and set a scene for what came afterwards.
And I guess also, was there an element of altered state kind of taking over from there as well?
Not really, because, I mean, altered state is more a book about drug culture in a way. Mm. It's a book that's about the experience of dance music culture rather than the music specifically. It doesn't really go very much into the musical development at all. It's more how this scene developed within Britain, the start of Acid House, the precursors to Acid House, the start of Acid House, this massive explosion of the rave scene in the late 80s, and then what happened afterwards when that kind of druggy bohemia became democratized. So, and it doesn't really go too much into the development of forms, you know, like trance or UK garage or anything like that. I mean, it could have done, but that would have been a very different book, I think.
Yeah. And what were your early experiences yourself with rave culture?
With rave culture, I come from Nottingham, which is in central England and in the Midlands, the East Midlands, in fact. And we were lucky enough to have a small club there called The Garage, where the DJ was one of the early adopters of house music, New York garage, the early Detroit techno. He was bringing the first Chicago acid imports and playing them. And so we were very lucky to be exposed to that music kind of in the mid 80s. So that was really my entry point to that electronic dance music. Although, yeah, obviously, as a young teenager, I'd been listening to synth pop. I'd also been listening to industrial music. Got a few Stockhausen records, you know, exploring that avant-garde side of electronic music as well. Now for me, the whole thing about acid house and techno, it kind of created a platform where all these kind of weird noises that I loved were wedded to this, you know, propulsive, compulsive beat, which I also love. So for me, it was a coming together of two very beautiful things.
Mm. Did you dig into the social fabric of that as well at the time? Was that important to you?
I don't think exactly at the time you don't realise how significant something is when you're living through it. It's just what you're living through. And it was complete chance that I lived in Nottingham and was exposed to this kind of music. I could have lived in another city and never come into contact with it. Mm. So, yeah, I don't know how much there was an element of design in all that, but you felt that it was something really exciting. And it was also something that was special because most people didn't know about it. I think that's one difference between the club culture of the 80s and the club culture that we have now, is that it's well known to everyone. There are obviously kind of the secret and obscure sections within it that aren't well known to the general public, but at that point nobody knew anything about it. This kind of underground culture of nocturnal hedonism and endlessly repetitive beats, it was obscure to the general public completely, and you really felt like you were part of some secret society.
And I mean, obviously things have changed a lot, and now it does feel to me that the idea of having like a legit subcultures and underground communities feels a lot harder because of obviously perhaps things like social media and our interconnected digital lives. Do you feel that there is a way that subcultures or underground culture can flourish in our current climate?
I think the subcultures and underground cultures do flourish and will continue to flourish because people will always find a way to do something interesting.
Do you feel that has to be something that is more offline now?
Again, you can't not be part of the society you live in, can you? The online world pervades the offline world and actually often exists in the same space as the offline world. And it's very hard to distinguish one from the other at certain points. So I just think that creative people are going to do creative things. Mm. They aren't going to be stopped.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a part of who we are, isn't it?
It's just a part of who we are. And especially if you've grown up with that as a constant in your life, that will become a factor that you will either use or react against. And as previous cultures have done with the social environments around them.
Mm. And on your early days as well, so you were raving, you were interested in electronic music.
We didn't even call it raving in those days. I don't think there was even a name for it. You were just going out.
Right, just going. But then I guess you were kind of aware of when it did become a bit of a thing that there were, you know, raves going on. And, you know, I remember being really young and hearing the kind of demonization of it in the media as well. Like, what were your impressions of that at the time when you kind of noticed that you know, like this sort of orbital circuit rave, you know, on London orbital raves and things like that, and the demonization of this culture? Were you participating at the time, or what were your impressions of that?
I think first of all, there was an underground club culture in Britain, all over the country, but it was relatively small. Mm. And I think that there was a moment where it was like everything went into day glow, as someone has described it. So not exactly overnight, but in a period of a couple of months, things changed massively, and the whole culture started to attract increasing numbers of people, and you started to get these illegal outlaw parties in fields and aircraft hangars and warehouses. And to the participants, at least, it felt like something that was massively exciting and totally new. Yes, there was kind of a backlash in the tabloid media about young people taking ecstasy and dancing all night to music that sounds like a washing machine being thrown down the stairs. But it didn't initially make that much difference to the participants. I mean, actually, it worked in completely the opposite way. I mean, tabloid media thought they were warning about the threat to Britain's innocent youth with these shock horror headlines about ecstasy and acid house. But actually, those headlines, that colourful coverage, actually acted as an advertisement and encouraged many more inquisitive young people to want to get involved. You know, all night dancing, psychedelic drugs, weird music. Where do I go for this?
Exactly. It's what you want, isn't it?
Oh, yes, certainly is.
And I remember at that time, or maybe it was even a couple of years later then, in like the early 90s, I felt that that was kind of reflected in some dance records, kind of taking that theme on. And there was all of these sort of records that would sort of play around with like drug connotations and like sort of childhood sort of British nostalgia in that as well. Like, you know, the kind of, do you remember the Charlie and I tune by The Prodigy? Or there was the whole kind of rhubarb and custard stuff. I definitely feel like early British rave producers really capitalized on, and of course The Shaman with Ebenezer Good, really capitalized on that fascination for it.
I don't think the connection between psychedelic drugs and electronic music was that new at that point. Mm. However, I do have to say, I mean, I think this is something that goes back to the 1960s. The most famous of the kind of 1960s electronic records, whatever you call it, electronics, you might call it music on credit. Anyway, Tomorrow Never Knows by the Beatles, that was completely inspired by LSD and actually took its lyrics from Timothy Leary's version of Tibetan Book of the Dead, which was intended to be used as a guide for an acid trip. And, you know, I think the thing about electronic music and psychedelic drugs is that there is no coincidence that they have a connection. It's because they're both offering the same thing. They're both offering to take you out there, from take you beyond human consciousness, take you into kind of some kind of new world. So you got the same thing in the 1970s with the hippie festival scene and psychedelic bands like Gong, who had a synthesizer player, which added that kind of those cosmic vibrations to their freaked out hippie sound. And so band like Hawkwind, who had completely abstract avant-garde space noise blurting out over their kind of heavy riffing. So yeah, psychedelic drugs and electronic music have had a long and quite fruitful partnership over the years.
Yeah, I mean, mentioned Hawkwind. My first introduction to Hawkwind was Silver Machine, which I always thought sounded like Status Quo with an oscillator over it. And and that's not necessarily a bad thing. But you also, in the book, you cover ground that has been covered before, but like you managed to find new ways to do that. Like, so for example, there's the big long overdue reappraisal of Delia Derbyshire. I wouldn't even say reappraisal, but just appraisal of Delia Derbyshire. You know, it's been covered in Cozy Fanny Tutti's book, various other places. Was that quite daunting for you to find new ways to talk about some elements in the book that have already been covered before?
I think a lot has been written about people like Delia Derbyshire because she was the woman who realized perhaps the most important piece of British electronic music ever, the theme for the Doctor Who series. That kind of acted as an advertisement for electronic music to an entire generation of young people who when Doctor Who became massively popular. I mean, it was only supposed to be running for a few weeks when they first started it, but it's still going today. I mean, a lot has been written about the BBC Radiophonic Workshop as well, where Delia Derbyshire did the theme for Doctor Who. But I think its influence is so large because so many electronic musicians that I interviewed told me that they grew up listening to the sounds that the BBC Radiophonic Workshop produced for television and radio shows, or the radio shows that they used to, the sounds for the radio shows that were broadcast in schools. I mean, is there even a theory that this is why Britain became such a massive force in synth pop in the 80s? Because it was this generation who grew up listening to electronic music from the Radiophonic Workshop and on TV and radio every day when they were children. So I think it was more a question of putting it into a context of how this all fitted into society at the time, was what I was trying to do. I mean, now every piece of information that you might want to find is available. The question is, what does it all mean?
There's definitely a very pick and mix kind of vibe to the book, the all of the subjects that you're covering. When I've opened the book up and read it, like I'm reading it in a fashion that I'm reading it in, I hope you don't mind, but I'm reading it in a non-linear fashion, and I'm opening chapters based like how I would do if I go into a record shop, like going, I fancy a bit of bleep techno today, and so right. I'll read about that.
Well, I'm not sure. As I said, I don't think that one can cover it absolutely everything, and I think that anyone's interpretation of this will be different from the next person's. There is no such thing as a definitive history. The idea of what is a history of a period changes with time as well, doesn't it? So so much of this is subjective. I don't agree with the idea of this is a definitive history of this period or this idea. I don't know, and also I don't know what I'm talking about. So
what do you feel is the responsibility of a music writer or a journalist in this situation, then, knowing that you can't create a definitive history? What is the responsibility?
Write something interesting.
Yep. Well, it definitely does that. Matthew, thank you so much. I'm absolutely loving the book. Like I sort of mentioned, I'm reading it like going into a record shop and treating myself to chapters, and that kind of excitement of going, I'm gonna go here today and gonna go here today. I apologize for not reading it in a linear order, but it's a beautiful book.
Thanks, it's very kind.
And thanks so much for joining me today.
Cheers. Appreciate it. Thanks, Paul.
Okay, thanks, Matthew. That's me, Paul Hamford, talking with Matthew Collin for Lost and Sound podcast. And we had that chat on April 27th, 2024. Dream Machines is available now through all good bookshops via the publisher Omnibus Press. My book, Coming to Berlin, is available good bookshops and via the publisher's website, Velocity Press. And Lost and Sound is sponsored by Audio-Technica. Audio-Technica are a global but still family-run company that make headphones, turntables, cartridges, microphones. They make studio-quality yet affordable products because they believe that high-quality audio should be accessible to all. So head on over to audiotechnica.com to check out all of their range of stuff. Thanks to Thomas Giddens for making the music that you hear at the beginning, at the end of every episode of Lost and Sound. And mostly, thanks to you. Thanks so much for listening. Hope whatever you're doing, you're having a fantastic one. And chat to you soon.